Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today, looking forward to our discussion. We'll be talking about Tony Abbott's recent speech he delivered in London, a wide-ranging assessment of the future of the centre-right. We'll also be discussing the role of big business and industry groups in the major debates, including the Voice to Parliament. Tony, great to be back with you.
Dan, wonderful to be with you and with our viewers.
Great. So let's kick off with this wide-ranging speech you delivered, Tony, in London last Thursday. It was widely covered in the local media over there in the UK and also covered here in Australia in The Australian. I just want to read the last part of that because you end on a very hopeful and optimistic note. You say, "My sense is that peak insanity on climate and identity already may have passed. I have no doubt that our best days are yet to come if we can but fight the good fight, stay the course, and keep the faith." And keep the faith. End quote. Tony, maybe we could start with the sort of your optimism and your cause for optimism on the centre right across the Western world.
Well, the main reason for my trip to London, Dan, was to attend the International Democrat Union, which was having a 40th anniversary conference to look at this broad issue of where to for the centre right. Of course, the IDU was the original brainchild of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And there's a sense in which the centre-right triumphed magnificently in the late 80s with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of Soviet communism, and as we then were told, the end of history because liberal capitalism was triumphing everywhere. What we discovered in the aftermath of 2001, what perhaps we should never have forgotten, is that history never stops. History is ongoing, and there's a sense in which no battle is ever finally won. It's just something that you are ahead or behind in at any one time. And I guess the difficulty for the centre-right at the moment is that, at least in the Anglosphere countries, we seem to have lost our way a little. The current British Conservative government is perceived to lack courage and conviction. Yep. The Republican Party is a little confused over whether it's a political movement or a personality cult in the United States. And while I think Peter Dutton is doing very well here in Australia, you can't say the same thing about the Liberal Party in all of the states. And I think you can say that the recent coalition federal government was, in some important respects, a disappointment. What I said to the Danube Institute, which was probably my key speech of the recent trip, is that Reagan and Thatcher had to face down the challenge of Marxism in the form of the old Soviet Union. What we need to face down is, in some ways, a more insidious challenge. It's the neo-Marxism, which has become so entrenched in so many of our institutions, in particular in our education systems. And this is why we've got so many young people obsessing about climate. This is why so many young people seem confused as to whether they're male or female. They don't seem to think biology comes into it as much as we always used to regard as self-evident. So there are some challenges for the centre-right, but I do think that there are some green shoots of hope. One of the byproducts of the massive increase in gas, oil, and coal prices as a result of the Ukraine war is people starting to ask themselves, isn't it really important to keep the lights on as much as to reduce emissions? One of the byproducts of the rise of people complaining about the chemical sterilization which has been inflicted on so many young people as part of this whole wave of gender dysphoria, is that people are starting to think, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't be playing such games with biology. Mm. But I also want to stress, Dan, that while I wanted to leave my audience on a optimistic, hopeful note, we have a struggle ahead. Mm. We have a struggle ahead. Things have gone far the wrong way, and it's very important that we do not for a second think that this is going to be easy or become complacent, because quite literally, the future of our countries, our culture, and our civilization depends upon us regaining faith in ourselves. Mm. And just at the moment, Britain, which I regard as, in a sense, the cradle of modern civilization, is still plagued with self-doubt. We still see the Ramona elites complaining about everything when they should know better. And the United States, which for so long has seen itself as having, if you like, a manifest destiny to bring liberal democratic ideas to the wider world, which has done so much in terms of spending blood and treasure to keep the world free and safe, is certainly going through a period of acute self-doubt, of which the turmoil inside the Republican Party is simply one expression.
Yeah, Tony, you mentioned the end of the Cold War and the idea of the end of history, and I often think that that made us complacent on the right, that we had sort of just assumed that the values that we hold were self-evident, that we didn't need to defend anything anymore. But of course, the left just kept going. And you mentioned the sort of the transmogrifying from the Soviet Union to this sort of cultural Marxism. And I think it's important you say in your speech, in some ways, this, you know, what I'll call sort of identity politics, cultural Marxism, is in some ways more dangerous because it's internal rather than having a clear external enemy. Are you able to elaborate on that insight a little bit?
Well, I suppose at the heart of this postmodernist neo-Marxism is the idea that we can never really know truth, that nothing is really objective and real. It's all simply a social construct. It's the construct of imposed power structures. And I suppose the most striking example of how things have shifted is that for centuries we were advancing towards the liberal ideal of the liberal humane ideal of human equality, if not necessarily in outcomes and in talents, at least in terms of dignity and rights and responsibilities. And that was most marvellously expressed, I suppose, by Martin Luther King in his famous statement that he wanted his children to be judged on the content of their character, not the colour of their skin. In just a generation, in just a few short decades, we've forgotten all of that, or at least large swathes of our academe and the commanding heights of opinion have forgotten this. And now everything is conditioned by race and colour and gender, hence all this anxiety about so-called white privilege and male privilege. Now, this is incredibly insidious because in the end it denies people agency. It says that they are programmed by things beyond their control, just as economic Marxism said that individuals were simply cogs in some giant capitalist machine. This neo-Marxism says that individuals are completely programmed by outside forces, whether it's their skin colour or the patriarchy or whatever it might be. And again, it takes away your freedom. It takes away your self-respect. It disempowers people. It fundamentally disempowers people. And yet the whole glory of our existence is trying to be better. Mm. It's every day try to make better choices than yesterday, so that over time the world for us, for our families, for our communities, and ultimately for our countries is better than it was.
I want to just briefly drill down into maybe some policy areas because I think it's really interesting, and you touch on this a little bit, the realignment where lower income voters are moving more towards the centre right, and that's largely because the left has moved so far to the left on climate, on identity politics, on mass migration, other such matters. And you, you know, were probably the most successful opposition leader. You brought the coalition out of opposition into government in record time, netting something like 25 seats against all the odds. I always sort of thought of your time as opposition leader, as prime minister, as what I would describe as broad spectrum conservatism, where there was sort of economic liberalism, social conservatism. But you also, I guess, developed a role for government, for example, with paid parental leave and family policy, which some economic liberals didn't necessarily agree with. But I think in hindsight is, you know, whether you agree with PPL or other forms of supporting the family, I think that when you're looking at lower income voters, working class voters, these families clearly need help in the environment where you need to have 1.5 or 2 income earners. It's really hard for them. So I just wanted to sort of talk about the sort of the the policy direction of the centre right as you see it as moving into the next period.
I guess, Dan, fundamentally what I want to say is that government is not value free. I mean, government should support the police. Government should prefer intact families to sundered ones. Government should prefer successful business to unsuccessful ones, and it should support good, prefer good schools to bad ones, and so on. I mean, government has an interest in outcomes. And while we have to be careful about government becoming too big and too bossy and too overbearing, by the same token, government is not simply holding the ring. It's not simply holding the ring. It needs to, from time to time, interfere to drive good outcomes. I mean, take an obvious example. Eventually, the market will deal with substandard products, but some products are so substandard that they're a threat to safety, and so we need to have rules against that kind of thing. Now, the rules shouldn't be too prescriptive, and you can take good things like that too far, but nevertheless, government is not value-free, and this is the mistake I think that some of the libertarians make. They think it's government's job simply to hold the ring. So when I was Prime Minister, yes, I wanted capable women to have more kids, because the greatest vote of confidence that you can make is to have children, and not enough capable Australian women are having children these days. Now, I can understand why, because there are careers to pursue, there are incomes to be earned, there are all the costs involved in having children. And so my paid parental leave scheme was an attempt to recognise that other than that in the middle, I mean, there are the very well-to-do that can survive on one very large income. There are the people on welfare who don't live a luxurious life by any means, but in a sense the welfare system looks after larger families. And then there are people in the middle, and these are the ones you've just mentioned, people who these days often need two incomes to have a reasonable middle-class life. And for those who I might describe as middle-class aspirational women, to have more than one or two kids is often quite difficult. Hence, paid parental leave, which will keep the family income going for the 6 to 12 months when the principal carer, normally the woman, will be taking time off work, but the family still needs the income. I mean, the mortgage isn't suspended just because someone's taking time off to look after a child, the mortgage still has to be paid. That's why paid parental leave, I thought, was critically important, and I thought was almost the archetype modern conservative policy. And I was so disappointed. I kind of expected the radical left to be against it once they worked out that this was really a pro-natalist policy, particularly coming from someone who self-identified as a conservative. But I was so disappointed that some of my colleagues were deeply resentful, particularly some of my older colleagues who said, well, my wife didn't get paid parental leave, so why should anyone else get it? And I just thought that was so backward-looking and so wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think you make an important point about the governments aren't value neutral. Clearly, they have a role to play in, you know, the court system and other such matters. But my view is that more intellectual thinking needs to be done on the right about what the proper role is of government in our day and age, which is much different to the situation in the 1980s, for example. We're in a much different situation. So there is the sort of the family situation, pay parental leave that you discuss. You know, there's also challenges that we have with the sort of migration and the rapid population growth and many other areas where I think the centre-right may have been apprehensive to involve itself in some years ago. But with the changing dynamic of sort of our culture and political system, I think some of those shifts towards, you know, what might be described as, you know, more conservative policy should be considered. Mm. Also, John Roskam wrote an important article in the Australian Financial Review, I think it was last Friday. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote it verbatim. But he basically made this important point, which is that people are really looking to be cared for today. I think the experience of COVID, the fragmentation of our society, families breaking up, that there is an expectation for government to do more and more. And the right has to find a way of talking to that desire without necessarily conceding the ground on big government. So just interested in your thoughts there. Yeah, look,
that's a good point you make, Dan. But we need to be very careful about a government which does so much that it takes away our freedom, and everything that government does has to be paid for, and government doesn't have a dollar that it doesn't take from us, either as taxes today or taxes tomorrow. So we do need to be careful. And one of the, I think, baleful consequences of COVID was this fostering of fear by government and officialdom, and I guess the consequent timidity of our public. I mean, even now we see people wearing masks. Now, if you've got a lurgy and you're in close quarters with other people, maybe it's courteous to wear a mask, but wearing a mask for self-protection, I think, is drawing a pretty long bow. And yet it seems that that's why most people are wearing masks, almost a sign that they don't want anyone to get too close to them. And, and again, this was one of the really, really unfortunate developments of COVID. There was a slogan that I, excuse me, that I saw daubed on buildings and in hoardings and things in Victoria during the pandemic. Staying apart brings us together, or something to that effect. And I thought, this is just so wrong. It's just so wrong. But this was the weirdness of those times.
Indeed, Tony. Well, a lot there to, I think, for us to unpack further over the coming weeks and months. I wouldn't mind now just turning to the Voice to Parliament and the latest developments there. Peter Dutton was on Sky News on Sunday, and he made, a pretty important point about big business, and he was talking especially about some in the mining sector and the resources sector that have been putting in millions into the Yes campaign. Yeah. And he's basically said that they should stay out of it, and they should grow a backbone, and rather than trying to appease the inner city Twitterati, should actually do what's right for our nation. To me, that's such an important observation by Peter Dutton, 100% correct as well. Interested in your observations of what Peter Dutton has had to say. plus also if you could give us an insight into your experience when you were Prime Minister into the role of big business and how that might have changed in the intervening decade or so.
Thanks, Dan. I think we've got to appreciate that big business and small business are very different beasts. And if we can further differentiate, there's a world of difference between large public companies and companies which may be publicly listed, but which are still essentially founder or family driven, such as News Corporation, for instance. And the big public companies these days, I think, are more like private sector bureaucracies than they are like small businesses. And one of the features of these private sector bureaucracies, particularly in recent times under the influence of this so-called ESG movement, is that instead of focusing on what business has traditionally focused on, namely delivering a worthwhile good or service, treating staff and customers well, and making a reasonable profit for shareholders, instead of those things, these ESG-driven businesses have been more interested in trying to build a invariably leftist-hued society. I think a significant factor, at least in this country, has been the dominance of the union super funds in the share registers of these large private companies. And so today we've got companies like Rio and BHP and Wesfarmers, each of them giving $2 million to the Yes case. Now, I think this is an absolute rip-off on the shareholders, a complete and utter rip-off on the shareholders. If a private company wants to donate to whatever cause, I may or may not agree, but nevertheless, at least it's in a sense entitled to do what it wants with its own money. But these are shareholders in the end who are missing out because Rio and BHP and Wesfarmers have decided that rather than run their business as well, they want to do a bit of political grandstanding. Yep. Now, I accept that Rio's got a guilty conscience after what it did to the heritage-listed Juukan Gorge. I accept that all of these large companies have got to stay in good with government and that Labor governments in particular play favourites when it comes to business. I also accept that big sport has always got its hand out to government for funding, for stadia and so on and so forth. And so big sport probably wants to pander to the government's latest pet project as well. But it's quite wrong that these massively resourced companies and these woke foundations should be so one-sided when it comes to the most important constitutional change we've been asked to consider. I mean, I know that the polls have been coming strongly back towards the sensible side of the voice debate, but that's not because the No campaign has had much money. I mean, the No campaign has been massively outspent by the Yes campaign. It's only because the No campaign has the better arguments that things are shifting. So look, I really think the people in these large public companies should be ashamed of themselves, frankly. They don't have an argument. All they have is an emotion and a desire to look good to the government.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. There's a couple of things that come to mind. The first is that this clearly obliterates any notion that the Voice is a grassroots movement. I mean, people are not reaching into their back pocket to give $5 or $10 in the same way they're doing to the No campaign. This is wealthy family trusts and big woke corporations that are funneling millions into the campaign. I think the other point, and as you were speaking, it sort of reminded me that we used to have business leaders that were patriotic. They actually cared about Australia. and they understood that one of the reasons behind their business success was the fact that they lived in a country like Australia. And yes, their own endeavour, their own efforts and investment are critical, but you would not have the same outcomes and returns if you weren't living and working in a country like Australia. They understood that and always, generally speaking, acted in the national interest. Now we've got these business people that just sort of opine and intervene on very divisive issues. You know, is it your experience that the quality, for want of a better term, or the commitment of our business leaders to our country has declined over time? Or do you have any sort of perspective on that?
I'm reluctant to accuse big business of lacking patriotism. I think the problem with big business is more a reflection of the general culture. And I can't remember the name of the author at the moment, but there was this distinction drawn somewheres versus anywheres. And the people who run large public companies,
Goodhart,
yep. That's right, Goodhart, yep. The British academic Goodhart. Yep. The people who run large public companies normally epitomise the anywheres, whether it's London, New York, Paris, Beijing, Tokyo. They're in their five-star hotels. They're often enough in their private jets and so on. Most of us are still very conscious that we are a product of a particular time and place. Mm. And generally speaking, we don't lightly change our religion, change the footy team we follow, suddenly decide that our hometown was pretty contemptible after all and we'd rather be a citizen of the world.
Yep.
So I think there's there's that factor at work. My admiration is for people who build businesses as opposed to simply manage them. And there are a lot of businesses, banks in particular, that are almost a license to print money. There are a lot of businesses that are largely protected from competition. I suppose some of the very big retailers might be in that category, and as I think I tried to say in that speech in London, if you don't have any real challenges, you start to worry. You start to create new challenges, and we've spent so much time over the last couple of decades worrying about what we used to call first world problems, because so much has gone well for so long. And I think that's, in the end, the problem with so many of these big business leaders. They've become bureaucratic as opposed to innovative in a business sense. But look, you asked me earlier, Dan, about the business bodies. Mm. At different times in the past, the business bodies have been very important to good government and to innovative government. Back in the 80s, when Hugh Morgan was leading the Business Council, it was a very important source of policy innovation. More recently, when Tony Shepherd was the president of the Business Council of Australia, the BCA was a very, important source of good counsel for people in public life. I think it's dramatically deteriorated since then, and I think it's because there have been too many people who haven't wanted to rock the boat, who would rather go with the flow, and who have forgotten that the only job that really counts for business is a good product or service, decent relations with your customers and your staff, and making a profit. Because a business that doesn't make a profit cannot last.
Tony, just returning to your speech and just to round out our conversation, there's an important point that you make here, which reminds me, I think, of a comment you made some time ago about the centre-right being, in government but not in power.
I think the word was in office but not in power.
In office but not in power. Yeah. Mm. And so this is what you say in your speech. It's one thing to win government. It's another thing to hold it and make something of it. Thanks to the left's long march through their institutions, center-right governments, despite winning elections and having mandates, must expect sabotage at every turn. You then go on to point to the media, the bureaucracy, in our case, the Senate, unions, and other internal factors. And to that, I would personally add what we've just talked about, big business and other major civic organisations. So can you just, you know, given your experience as Prime Minister back in 2013, how that affected your capacity to execute on the will or the imprimatur given to you by the Australian people, and then how has that changed over the last decade or so?
Well, it's interesting. Arguably, the Abbott government's greatest success was stopping the boats, and we were able to do that because we didn't need anyone else's permission. We didn't need to get any legislation through the parliament. It was something that we were able to do entirely through the executive action of the Commonwealth government. And within a couple of months, effectively, the boats had been stopped.
Yep.
Other things like the repeal of the carbon tax, the raising of the pension age, our desire to see school leavers either learning or earning as opposed to going on the dole, the desire to see a modest co-payment on otherwise bulk billed GP visits. All of these things required legislation, and while I think we had a clear mandate to get the budget under control, we certainly had a lot of trouble getting legislation through the Senate, even the repeal of the carbon and mining taxes, for which we had an absolutely explicit mandate, was difficult. So look, in retrospect, I think I should have been quicker to replace key people in the public service, and I should have been readier to go swiftly to a double dissolution election where I thought that the government's clear mandate was being thwarted by the parliament. But look, this is the wisdom of hindsight. I suspect that the next coalition government, certainly any government that Peter Dutton leads, will be a government which has been chastened, informed, and ultimately better prepared because of that experience.
We certainly hope so, Tony. So on that note, I think we'll wrap it up. So thanks for your time and your insights again, Tony, and looking forward to our chat next time.
Thanks so much, Dan.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.